The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. Our first article was published by the Associated Press on October 16 and written by Mari Yamaguchi, entitled Unification Church Slams Japan's Dissolution Request as a Threat to Religious Freedom, Tokyo. The Japanese branch of the Unification Church on Monday criticized the Japanese government's request for a court order to dissolve the group, saying it's based on groundless accusations and is a serious threat to religious freedom and human rights of its followers. Japan's education ministry on Friday called the Tokyo District Court to revoke the legal status of the Unification Church after a ministry investigation concluded the group for decades has systematically manipulated its followers into donating money, sowing fear, and harming their families. The investigation followed months of public outrage and questions about the group's fundraising and recruitment tactics after former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's assassination last year. The man accused of shooting Abe allegedly was motivated by the former Prime Minister's links to the church and blamed it for bankrupting his family. The government's request is extremely disappointing and regrettable, said the church's legal affairs department chief, Nobuo Okamura. We believe the request for a dissolution order is a serious development, not only for freedom of religion, but also human rights. The request asked the court to issue a dissolution order, revoking the church's status as a religious organization. The process involves hearings and appeals from both sides and would take months or possibly years. A church lawyer, Nobuya Fukumoto, criticized the government for not specifying which law the group violated and vowed to thoroughly fight in court. If the church is stripped of its legal status, it could still operate, but would lose its tax exemption privilege as a religious organization and would face financial setbacks. Some experts and lawyers supporting the victims have cautioned against an attempt by the church to hide its assets before a court decision. The church worries that the rare dissolution request hurts its image, said Susumu Sato, spokesperson for the group, which officially calls itself the Family Federation for World Peace and Unification. Church officials said followers and their families have been harassed at work and school. Decades of cozy ties between the church and Japan's governing Liberal Democratic Party were revealed since Abe's assassination and have eroded support for the Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's government. The Unification Church obtained legal status as a religious organization in Japan in the 1960s during an anti-communist movement that was supported by Abe's grandfather, former Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi. The church has acknowledged excessive donations, but says the problem has been mitigated for more than a decade. It also has pledged further reforms. Experts say Japanese followers are asked to pay for sins committed by their ancestors during Japan's 1910 to 1945 colonial rule of the Korean Peninsula, and that the majority of the church's worldwide funding comes from Japan. The only other religious organizations whose status was revoked are the Aum Shinrikyo Doomsday Cult, which carried out a sarin nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway in 1995, and the Myokai Kuji Group, whose executives were convicted of fraud. Now an opinion piece published on October 9 by RNS and written by Raju Rajagopal, co-founder of Hindus for Human Rights and a member of America Against Caste Discrimination. Titled, Governor Newsom Put Concerns of Caste Privileged Communities Over Civil Rights. When Senator Strom Thurmond and other Southern Democrats set out to defeat the landmark civil rights legislation of the 1960s, they argued that there was no need to take any measures to counter racism in the U.S. since, in Thurmond's words, there are already ample laws on the statute books. In order to bestow preferential rights on a favored few, the South Carolinian said, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 would sacrifice the constitutional rights of every citizen and would concentrate in the national government arbitrary powers unchained by laws to suppress the liberty of all. He further charged that it would restrict employers in hiring and firing and give government bureaucrats the power to decide what is discrimination. Similar arguments were made by Governor Gavin Newsom of California on Saturday, October 7, as he vetoed a bill known as SB 403 that would have banned caste discrimination in education, housing, and employment throughout California. Passed with overwhelming support in the state's assembly in early September, after being introduced by freshman Senator Aisha Wahab in February, SB 403 was a response to the testimonies of hundreds of Silicon Valley workers of South Asian background who say they have experienced discrimination on account of their low caste status. The case of one such worker, in fact, had drawn the attention of the California Civil Rights Department, which filed a lawsuit in 2020 against the tech giant Cisco and two of its former employees, who were accused of identifying the worker as a Dalit, the preferred term for communities derogatorily referred to historically as untouchables. The scurrilous implication of being outed in this way is to suggest that a worker is a beneficiary of India's affirmative action programs for Dalits, and therefore less competent. The two employees have since been dropped from the complaint, but the caste discrimination case against Cisco continues. Central to the Cisco case is the company's refusal to act on the employee's complaint, stating that caste discrimination is not illegal in California. SB 403 was an effort to address this serious gap. By formally adding caste to the list of protected classes under California civil rights statutes, which now include race, color, ancestry, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, sex, pregnancy, religion, disability, age, military or veteran status, and marital status, it was hoped that companies could not legally ignore caste bias. Responding to unrelenting protests from Hindu nationalist groups, who claimed SB 403 would cause all Hindus to be regarded as discriminatory if caste discrimination was formally recognized as wrong, the bill had been edited to list caste as a subset of ancestry, though it still contained a clear definition of caste. This dilution left many caste-oppressed communities wondering why caste discrimination would be considered any more acceptable than discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, which had remained on the list. But despite the compromise in language, Newsom vetoed the bill on a weekend as the world's attention was called to the Mideast. It is abundantly clear that he succumbed to political pressure from the same Hindu nationalist who demanded caste be stricken from the bill. The governor's explanation for his action is remarkably close to the position of these groups, led by the Hindu American Foundation. These opponents of the bill have been indulging in rank fear-mongering about the proposed law, spreading preposterous allegations in WhatsApp groups that SB 403 was an attack on Hinduism itself and would make Hindus, especially women, fearful of displaying their Hindu-ness in public. Left to themselves, many Hindu Americans would support SB 403, or at worst be agnostic. But caste oppressed communities are now in a state of shock. Saying caste discrimination is already covered under California's civil rights laws contradicts their experience and merely rubs salt into their wounds. Besides the insult to these Americans, Newsom has glossed over three important considerations. First, California's legal system isn't as capricious and arbitrary as HAF would have us believe. The Civil Rights Department has an elaborate process to vet complaints before legal action is taken on behalf of alleged victims. The case against Cisco was the first caste discrimination allegation the CRD had taken up. They didn't get everything right, but lessons from that case will only strengthen CRD's ability to fairly pursue future cases, which will continue to arise despite or because of the governor's veto. Had SB 403 existed at Cisco when its employee complained of caste discrimination, the case would most likely have been resolved within the company itself. Employers, in response to the law, would have been encouraged by SB 403 to put in place appropriate policies and training programs on caste, as some are already doing. The HAF's protest and the governor's veto, however, will have a chilling effect, discouraging other employers from addressing caste at all or implementing caste discrimination policies. Second, Newsom has canceled the deterrent effect SB 403 would have had on caste discrimination before it occurs, as well as its legal effect in ensuring Dalits would not need to worry about being outed at work and would be granted the self-confidence to be themselves at the workplace. Finally, in its separate lawsuit against the CRD, HAF made the extraordinary claim that by defining caste as a Hindu ideology, the CRD would actually require the very discrimination that it seeks to ban, and employers might arguably be required to accommodate an employee's request not to work with someone the employee believes to be of the wrong caste. The court dismissed that claim as both highly speculative and seemingly implausible. The court added that HAF, by trying to distance Hinduism from caste, while arguing that SB 403 would selectively target Hindus, was contradicting itself. The defeat of SB 403, I'm afraid, will only tempt HAF to continue to push these untenable positions. Caste discrimination is a sad reality that all Hindus must acknowledge and work together to annihilate. Knowing that it is perfectly possible to practice Hinduism while combating caste discrimination. Governor Newsom has missed an opportunity to support these simple facts. Instead, he has lifted up the irrational fears and speculations of a highly privileged community over the needs of caste-oppressed communities, who will continue to face biases because of who they are. But the fight is not over by any means. Those who demanded that caste be added as a distinct protected category in not only California's but also the nation's civil rights laws will, if anything, be strengthened in championing the vision of SB 403. We, the people who stand for justice for all, are the majority. In the meantime, the least that the governor can do is to issue a letter formalizing his claim that caste discrimination is already covered under existing laws and require all employers to implement policies and training programs to deal with caste discrimination complaints. The fight for SB 403 has been a remarkable journey, with a Muslim woman having the courage to introduce the bill and a diverse coalition of communities coming together to fight for it. We need such solidarity across our differences to win justice for any of our communities. The deep bonds we have all built through the fight in Seattle and now California will serve us well, indeed will be our lifeline in the struggles ahead. Now an article published by the Religion News Service on October 9, written by Catherine Post. In When Religion Hurts You, a psychotherapist argues religious trauma is trauma. Raised in an evangelical church she now describes as a dumpster fire of fundamentalist beliefs, Laura Anderson's terror of hell kept her up at night as a four-year-old. Her insomnia was less about hell itself and more about the fear of being separated from her family if Jesus came back. So she'd lie awake, picturing an image of Jesus dying on the cross, hoping it would guarantee salvation. Decades later, long after her sleeping patterns had regulated, she suddenly suffered from severe insomnia again, this time after she'd come to reject the idea of hell. Because of the way I had embodied those messages about the consequences of going to hell, my body started to panic again because I didn't have this assurance of salvation, Anderson explained. Her fears were still ingrained in her body. At the time, Anderson thought she was alone in experiencing a trauma response to her religious upbringing. But now, as a psychotherapist who specializes in religious trauma, she knows that's not the case. In her new book, When Religion Hurts You, Healing from Religious Trauma and the Impact of High Control Religion, Anderson gives language for and insights about this under-researched form of trauma and invites readers to take part in the ongoing process of healing. RNS spoke to Anderson about purity culture, why atheism isn't a remedy for religious trauma, and how to identify high-control religions. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. What do you mean when you say religious trauma is trauma? Prior to the last 5, maybe 10 years, most dialogue around religious trauma in professional spaces suggested that to heal from it, you just needed to become an atheist. And for a myriad of reasons, I disagree with that. It can turn into fundamentalism very quickly, just on the other side of the spectrum. Also, that cognitive shift to atheism doesn't address how trauma is embodied, how those messages, practices, and lifestyles live inside of us even after we believe new things. Research and clinical interventions show us trauma is a physiological state that is happening in our bodies. It is the result of anything that's too much, too fast, too soon, that overwhelms our ability to cope. So when we understand religious trauma as trauma, it gives us a wealth of resources and interventions. It also helps to validate the actual lived experience. Many of my clients have experienced shame and confusion over having psychological responses, even after they don't believe the same things anymore. Understanding the religious trauma helps us wrap our minds around what's happening in our bodies, and then opens the door for compassion toward yourself and healing in a deeper, more embodied way. Why might it be important for therapists working with religious trauma not to be anti-religion? Anti-religious messages can quickly become prescriptive and fundamentalist. To say all religion is terrible and you just have to get rid of it, or the idea that God is dumb and only for mentally weak people, is incredibly shaming and discouraging. It's also not necessarily helpful for the healing process. My job as a therapist is not to get you to a belief that I might hold. It is to help you heal and to learn and to lean in more to who you are authentically. I think that includes religion or spiritual practices. Now, I always say I'm not anti-religion, but I am anti-harm and power and control and anti-abuse. So if you find a religion or faith or spiritual practice that isn't including those things, I think that's wonderful. What's the difference between religious abuse and religious trauma? Trauma is not the thing that happens to you. It's the result of how your nervous system responds to the thing that happens to you. Trauma is very subjective, and that means no event or single doctrine is inherently traumatic. Think of a car accident. Some people might walk away from it being deeply traumatized, and other people don't. Abuse is the thing that happens to you. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you're abused, you will absolutely have trauma, though there's a higher likelihood of it, especially if it's repeated or inescapable, as we often see in the context of high-control religions. It's also important to note that even if the abuse you experienced inside religion did not result in trauma or a diagnosis such as PTSD, that doesn't mean you didn't suffer severe consequences from it. It just means that your body did not store it as trauma. How can we identify when a religion is a high-control religion? In the back of the book, I talk about what I call the religious power and control wheel. There's a diagram, and you'll see categories like isolation, minimizing, denying, and blaming, spiritual abuse, economic control, defining gender, and sexual rigidity. What's important to recognize about high-control religion is that it's never just about one thing. It's these seemingly benign or small things that are compounded, that are consistent and persistent, and oftentimes have severe consequences attached. And when religious trauma, and then with religious trauma, if you defy the rules they set, then you are defying God. And if you're defying God, the likelihood of eternal conscious torment, for example, is quite high. You can also ask, what happens when somebody leaves? What happens when somebody expresses disagreement? What happens when somebody shows up as themselves in a way that might be different than how the group defines what is okay or normal? How are they treated? There's a lot of research that talks about healing as a symptom reduction or alleviation. As I was doing my research for my doctoral dissertation, I had this idea that healing from all these things that happened to me would look a particular way, and it didn't. In fact, in many cases, it felt like I was getting further and further away, which meant my shame was increasing exponentially. So my dissertation chair told me, I just think you might have a really limited definition of healing. Through research, what I discovered is that when we allow ourselves to consider that healing doesn't have a finish line, it allows us to be present in our day-to-day life. It let me have more compassion for myself, tune into my body, and figure out what I needed. Our last article is an excerpt from one published by the Religion News Service on October 10 and written by Catherine Post. One House Music's new EP hopes to be Christian music for a non-Christian audience. With an eclectic mix of R&B, pop, gospel, and hip-hop, the new EP, Eyes Up, from One House Music, a collective from the L.A.-based church One, a Potter's House Church, is explicitly designed for non-Christians. The mainstream electronic sounds are paired with messages about relying on God, overcoming addiction, and finding courage in dark times. And the counterintuitive combination seems to be working. I'd Be Lying, an Afrobeats-inspired single featuring UK Christian musician Sade and Grammy-winning songwriter and music leader Mitch Wong, has already been featured on Spotify's hugely popular New Music Friday playlist. I'd be lying if I said I don't need your love, the chorus repeats over a syncopated dance beat. I'd be lying if I said I don't need you, God. Touré Roberts, who co-leads the church with his wife, Sarah Jakes Roberts, daughter of Bishop T.D. Jakes, and founded the One House Music label in 2020, said he never imagined being an influential church leader shepherding a music collective. If you would have told me that I'd be doing it about 25 years ago, I would ask you what you'd been smoking and where I might inquire about how to get some, Roberts joked in a recent interview with RNS. Roberts wields his background in tech and entrepreneurship as a successful online preacher and on the ground in North Hollywood, where his church is known to attract people from every sector of the entertainment industry, including the likes of Tyler Perry, Mariah Carey, and Chance the Rapper. But while Roberts' style is practical and approachable, he believes One House Music can take that relatability a step further. We recognize that not everyone is ready for the Hallelujah song, to lift their hands, said Roberts, who added that One House Music aims to meet them with melodies and lyrics that can reach a broad audience. One House producer and music director Bruins Charles, who was working for the Dr. Phil show when he first joined One Church in 2017, came up with the idea to do a pop R&B record after One House Music's debut worship album, Live Again, which was released earlier this year. There are times I've been in church in my younger days, and I'd leave feeling the same thing. My questions and prayers didn't get answered. I still feel broken, still didn't feel close to God, still struggling, said Charles. We're hoping it will allow people to rip off the mask and not feel ashamed for sharing where they are honestly in their walk of life. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.